The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and it's so nice to have you here with us this evening. With the exception of agriculture, more women in the developing world work as artisans or hand workers than in any other profession. And an organization that has embraced this global community of women is Nest. And you will hear from its founder and executive director, Rebecca Van Bergen, who tells us the mission of the organization.
Our mission as an organization is to help empower the global community of artisan workers, but more than just grassroots impact for each of those businesses. We also want to rethink the way we as consumers, as brands, as anybody, think about the hand worker economy and what its potential is for supporting women globally.
And then I will be joined by Holly Carter, the founder and executive director of Buy Kids, an organization that helps kids across the world tell their stories through documentary film. And Holly will tell us why she believes kids make the best reporters.
Oh, they're so amazing. They see the world. They have a nose for BS. They don't care about your ego or your politics. They report the way they see things. Totally authentically.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, February 3rd. The World Health Organization revealed that teenage drinking has declined across Europe, the continent with the highest rates of drinking in the world. The country with the largest decline? Britain. And France revealed a sharp fall in daily smokers, with 1 million fewer lighting up in the past year. A new tax on transportation fringe benefits that some charities offer their employees will cost an average of $12,000 per nonprofit, prompting some to consider ending those perks, according to a new study. The staff and leadership of museums across the United States has become more diverse since 2015, a report commissioned by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation finds. The survey found that in 2018, 28% of all museum staff were people of color, up from 24% in 2015. While 62% of leadership positions were held by women, up from 57%. And finally, the Pennsylvania Avenue building that houses a museum will soon be converted into an educational facility for Johns Hopkins University. They have acquired it from the Freedom Forum for a reported $372 million. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Rebecca Van Bergen of Nest right after this.
Most teachers spend over $500 of their own money every year on school supplies because classrooms lack books, art supplies, even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help schools get the resources they need most. Bring a classroom dream to life. Visit DonorsChoose.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
It is estimated that as much as 60% of garment manufacturing is subcontracted to artisans working out of their homes. These are primarily women, working in developing economies and where it is very difficult to certify standards. We all know what so often occurs in circumstances like that, especially with no one advocating on these women's behalf. Enter Nest, a nonprofit organization founded in 2006 and which has taken up this cause with remarkable energy and creativity. And it's wonderful to have with us this evening its founder and executive director, Rebecca Van Bergen. Good evening, Rebecca, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a snapshot of Nest and what the organization was created to do.
Our mission as an organization is to help empower the global community of artisan workers, but more than just grassroots impact for each of those businesses. We also want to rethink the way we as consumers, as brands, as anybody, think about the hand worker economy and what its potential is for supporting women globally.
You know, you started Nest in 2006 when you were only 24 and having just completed your master's in social work at Washington University in St. Louis. How did this story get started and how did Nest come to be?
Sure. The year that I graduated, Muhammad Yunus had just won the Nobel Peace Prize for microfinance, and in international development circles, at least, it was starting to be considered a solution to poverty, and people all over the world were starting to give out loans. And from the social work perspective, which is really sort of about individual practice with a woman or a man about kind of increasing their agency, microfinance seemed like it would carry a lot of challenges in that it's debt primarily. It doesn't mean that you'll have a successful business. And so I was really interested and kind of rethinking how business could support increasing women's agency around the world, but in a way that wasn't solely reliant on debt. And so our original mission, which is still today, was about how to support women artisans in particular. It's the second largest employer of women in developing economies. So really seemed like the place where women were working to grow their businesses, with sort of an emphasis on the exporting marketplace, given that I was based here in the United States.
You know, you were in many ways destined to start a nonprofit. Your mother started one. Your aunt started one. Tell us about your upbringing and the influence that these two women, as well as your grandmother, had on your career path.
Sure. I mean, I think I only realized some of it later in life, but my dad was a for-profit entrepreneur. My mom did start a nonprofit. My aunt started a nonprofit just 2 years ago. My sister did. So it clearly runs in the family, both entrepreneurship, but then also, while my dad was a for-profit entrepreneur, the others were nonprofits. So the kind of social justice was a big part of my childhood and childhood discussions. We were involved politically and socially on a number of levels. But my grandmother was also originally from rural North Carolina, and she grew up on a tobacco farm, and her mother was a quilter and sewer and was so by necessity. I mean, she made quilts out of rags, and like that was before upcycling was like a cool thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, craft was also a part of my life. My grandmother was always sewing. She made all my mom's clothes, and so I think it was only later that I realized that combination of things, seeing the power that craft has for women in particular, and then also this kind of inherent drive to do something with my life that was meaningful for social problems that I was seeing around me, kind of all combined in a perfect storm.
Yeah, it does seem to be a pretty good fit, doesn't it? Let me ask you, Rebecca, about the word artisan. What do you think that word conveys to most people, and do you think it portrays an accurate picture?
And I think it's interesting because when I started Nest now almost 13 years ago, nobody was using the word artisan. And now everybody is using the word artisan. We sort of keep a running joke list at the office of the bizarre ways you see the use of word, you know, the word artisan, like artisan hotel or artisan potato chips. Like, what does that actually mean? And so I think while there has been this kind of steady increase in the handmade and local and artisan, that's really good in a lot of ways. The downside to that is that it dilutes what the term means for a lot of people. So I think UNESCO actually has a definition of artisan around kind of the majority of the product being produced by hand, but it can include the use of some machinery or tools, which we really like. But, you know, I think it's a hard term to define. And I think one of the things we'll start talking about is that there's a lot of people working in their homes with their hands that haven't necessarily been considered an artisan, and the work may or may not be skilled. And so artisan may or may not be the right term for them. So our organization, we've actually embraced the word handwork.
Right.
And we use it more often actually than artisan to really speak about the wide array of ways that women are using their hands as their primary source of income.
Yeah. And not only was artisan not being used 13 years ago when you started the organization, sustainable fashion really didn't exist either, did it?
No, it didn't. So there's been a lot of kind of industry trends around sustainable fashion, transparency, artisan that have really helped propel the work forward.
Yeah. You know, when you think of garment production, I think almost everybody thinks of those big old factories, with a lot of people working in those factories. But there is quite an invisible workforce that we've alluded to out there. Tell us about them.
Sure. I think, you know, I learned about this on the go. I think they're very invisible. So I think most people, including myself, didn't know a lot about this. But as we started looking into bringing transparency to artisans who are largely working in their homes or unregulated workshops, as brands were increasing their artisan sourcing, we all of a sudden had brands coming to us that didn't really have a quote-unquote artisan agenda or artisan products in their supply chain. And we really started realizing that there was a lot of production happening that was being subcontracted, which means that the factory gives that order to other people, whether it's in a different factory or a different unregulated workshop or eventually into homes. And this is considered homework, but historically in the industry, a lot of companies had quote-unquote no home worker policies where they forbid that type of subcontracting because they couldn't have transparency. But the unintended consequence of that was that it pushed a lot of it underground. So factories still did it. They just didn't tell anyone.
Right.
So it actually ended up kind of increasing the risk for those women in a lot of ways. But so that, you know, the statistic is actually that there's anywhere between 20 to 60%, right, which I actually love because it shows that nobody has any idea.
Nobody knows.
Like 20
well, the
and 60 are like
sparse, yeah.
Very, very different
range.
Numbers. Exactly. And so, and as we talked, our, you know, the only way they find out is through disclosure or kind of happening upon it. And so it hasn't been formally tracked until now.
Yeah. And many of these women who work out of their homes really don't have any other choice, do they?
No, I think what, you know, we really advocate, like in my vision for 5 years from now, or maybe it will take 10, but hopefully just five. If you were a company or a brand or retailer and you said you had a no home worker policy, that would be akin to saying I have an anti-woman policy. I mean, for so many of these women, they live in locations where their husbands might not allow them to work outside of the home. They might be rurally located, which would mean urban migration and leaving their families behind. And so there's, you know, there's so many reasons, childcare, disability, that women really rely on home-based work. And so those policies have had a negative effect for a lot of women, and we're really hoping that increased transparency can mean that homework is a viable option for women around the world.
So, Rebecca, how does Nest work? I mean, what does it mean for an artisan to be part of the Nest Guild?
Sure.
And what are some of the benefits that you do give them?
Sure. So we work in sort of two ways in parallel that obviously intersect quite a bit. We're a nonprofit organization, and so the majority of our funding is philanthropy, and we invest in the global community of artisans. So we run what we call the Guild, which you just mentioned, which is an open access network for artisan businesses around the world. It's free to join. It's now over 500 businesses and a footprint of 92 countries, and we provide a range of resources for those businesses, including kind of one of our most active programs is a pro bono consulting program. So anyone with skills, so listeners with skills, can volunteer their time, and they get matched with an artisan business, whether it's accounting or product development or building a website. And so we kind of help support business growth through that program and a variety of others. And then the remainder of the time we spend consulting with brands and retailers that want to be investing in artisan supply chains but don't necessarily know how to do that ethically, with transparency, et cetera. And so we have a range of programs that really help ensure that when brands are buying from all of the artisans in our guild, they're doing so in a way that's sustainable and transparent.
How do artisans find you? And do they have to do anything to qualify to be part of this Nest Guild?
It's amazing. It's through word of mouth, I guess. I mean, we do outreach sometimes too, and we travel a lot. And but largely, they find out about it through others. And I think once you start giving away resources, and the resources are free, people find out. So. So it grows. You know, the network actually grows by about 10% a month. So it's steadily growing without any kind of formal outreach, or very little. And we do have some criteria. Obviously, you have to be an artisan business. So we make sure that you're actually practicing an artisan technique. And then as a nonprofit, we really do have an emphasis on artisan businesses that are using that business for good. And so you have to meet one social criteria. You have to be in an area of high poverty or high unemployment. You have to have a gender equity lens, so women leadership, majority women entrepreneur, women artisans, or cultural preservation, which is our most fuzzy, since that obviously is hard to totally define. But I'd say the majority of artisan businesses meet multiple of those criteria.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your business. You've had two very interesting pivot points, at least that I'm aware of, since you started in 2006. And the first was about 5 years in when you changed your business model. How did it change, and what was the thinking behind it?
Sure. I mean, I think when we originally started, our goal was to help increase the market share for artisans. And so we were helping brands source directly from artisan communities, and we're acting like a middleman. We wanted to be an ethical middleman, but as a middleman.
Yeah.
So a brand wanted to produce a bag, we would connect with artisan business and produce that bag, and we made money on that. And so 90% of our revenue at the time came from producing product. But we really realized that by doing that, there was a lot of ethical issues with that business model. If a brand came to us and they wanted to produce, and we knew sort of what their kind of price restrictions would be, often we'd know that our cut was what was making the goods prohibitively expensive. And so if we weren't involved, the artisan probably could get the order. And we also had no incentive to eventually have the artisan business work directly with the brand when they were capable of doing so, because that was how we were making money. And so to be making money in that way felt really uncomfortable to us. And we also didn't ever make enough to invest enough in training for the artisan workforce so that they could eventually sustain those relationships. And so it was a really hard decision.
I bet.
Because a lot of our revenue is coming that way. But we decided to just kind of clean slate it and switch to 100% philanthropy. And we did that. And it was really successful. And I think has kind of opened our eyes into transparency and how kind of supply chains get structured, even when they're with artisans and so well-meaning. It's really, really important that there's transparency all the way through.
Yeah. And also, I'm sure these artisans became dependent upon you.
Exactly.
And you wanted them to be able to stand up and grow their own business.
Exactly.
if you were not around. The second was several years later, and you alluded to this a few moments ago, and that is when you returned to your earned income model, but now in a completely different way and with brands. Tell us what that looks like and who you work with.
Sure. So I think we realized eventually that our brands were continuing to come to us. They never left after that was our kind of original model. And so we kind of had a odd relationship with them for a couple of years because we weren't charging them or we didn't know how to charge them for services, but they were getting benefits. And so we really switched more to a consulting model where we support brands but are still not a middleman. So if a company wants to source, we help them find the appropriate partner, but it's sort of a one-time arrangement. But I'd say the majority of our work with brands is really that as Artisan has become increasingly popular, bigger and bigger companies want to source with artisans, and the bigger the company, the less likely it is that their systems are set up to work with small manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the work we do is around consulting with companies on how to create alternative kind of multifunctional pathways, that they can source from local makers or from artisans in a way that's different than how they onboard a factory. You know, like one of our partners is Target, and they have, you know, a binder for onboarding if you're a factory, and that would be really onerous for a small manufacturer. And so how can we create alternative solutions for kind of smaller manufacturers? And then I think we'll pivot to talking about transparency, but that's a big piece of what we do with companies.
Yeah. And who are some of the other brands you work with?
We work with I think it's really interesting. We work with a huge range of companies from Target to Patagonia to Hermes. And, mm-hmm. What I love about craft is that we work with Target, which is about kind of democratizing the ability to purchase craft, to Hermes, which is about really supporting the most exquisite, the most skilled artisans in the world. And so that there's a place at the table for both of those conversations within a singular movement is really exciting to me. West Elm here has been one of our kind of founding and core partners, and they have a huge and sustained commitment to artisan handcraft. So we're really lucky to work with some Eileen Fisher, some amazing companies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Technology is certainly vital to what you do. I just don't even know how you would ever go about trying to map this workforce, which is in homes and spread out across the world. Tell us about the Nest Remote Learning Center and the other ways that you've deployed technology.
Sure. I mean, I think technology is really critical on multiple levels. One, our global network, our guild, we want to deploy as much consulting and support to those people as possible. And while on-site is always the preference because you can meet face-to-face and it can be really impactful, it's not always possible. And so things like WeChat and Skype and, you know, email has been really profound in enabling us to provide support from afar to businesses on a capacity building front. On the transparency front, I think it's been interesting in two ways. One, I think even less about kind of the services we use. I think the writing is on the wall for everybody in the industry. The transparency is coming whether or not you like it. And so, things like blockchain and, you know, we're not technically using them, using blockchain yet, but I think people are fearful and or anticipatory that that's going to kind of take over and transparency will exist. So I think there's kind of a rush by the industry to better map their supply chains and know who's in them prior to people finding out without the brand's consent. And so I think that technology has really spurred the movement towards supply chain mapping for a lot of companies. And I think it shows a lot of promise for us. Right now, we use technology minimally. We actually do go sort of door to door, for lack of a better word, to meet with the home workers face to face. But you could, and right now when we get on site, generally there's not paper records, let alone digital ones. And so we really kind of are starting at the beginning. But you can see a day where instead of needing to have a paper wage receipt, you're being paid mobile money. And mm-hmm. so then there is documentation, which would make our lives easier, certainly. But it's sort of one step at a time. I think we don't want to scare anyone.
your organization is dealing with this on so many different levels. And one of those would be the NES Standards in SEAL. How does that work?
Sure. And I think one of the things, when we started the Guild, and so we have this network in 92 countries, one of the benefits of that was it kind of gave – people think of Artisan as very localized and very niche, mm-hmm. and that's because it is in many ways. It's, you know, traditions that have been passed down generationally. It's very tied to people's sense of community and family. But it's also this global workforce with massive economic implications for women, and I think that part of the story gets lost all the time in terms of how important this sector is, and it's been very under supported in a lot of ways because I think of this like misconception that it's very niche. And so one of the things that the Guild has provided us is this kind of global pulse on what are the challenges that are happening in Guatemala and in Swaziland and in Peru and in India and are happening everywhere, and how can we kind of help solve some of those sector-wide hurdles. And one of them was transparency, because they're working in homes. And so if a company wanted to do it ethically, what does that even look like? Because they're not set up to go door to door and see all of the artisans that they're working with. And so we had a tool we had developed called the Artisan Audit, which we used internally to make sure that we knew what was happening in the supply chains we were working with. And we were approached by West Elm actually about 4 years ago, whether we would turn that tool into an industry-facing tool. Mm-hmm. And so we did some diligence, and we couldn't believe that it was possible that there wasn't an industry standard for artisan or home-based work, but it turns out there wasn't.
Nope.
And so we really decided that if we were going to go down that journey, we wanted to do it for the industry at large, not just as kind of a singular partnership. And West Elm was really on board with that, because I think there's a lot of redundancy in like factories where, you know, there's actually a joke, and it's true, but factories will sometimes have four fire extinguishers because four different companies will have the requirement that you have to have one, but at different heights. And it's easier to have four than to change it every time someone's coming. And that's like a legitimate thing that's happening because people kind of want it alone. So we put together a committee of brands, many of the ones I mentioned mm-hmm. to you, and we spent 3 years co-authoring, piloting, refining the first industry standard for home-based work. We piloted in over 50 locations and worked with many labor organizations, many of our artisan partners to get their feedback, held roundtables with artisans and the brands to talk about child labor and some of the thornier issues, and then ended up launching this standard at the United Nations last year, which it was really exciting. And now has many companies have adopted it as their kind of standard operating procedure. And then one of the biggest services we provide brands is, you know, kind of quote unquote auditing to that standard. Mm-hmm. So going into their supply chains and mapping them. And then if passing artisan businesses, it carries a seal. So the seal actually just launched in West Elm in December.
Well, congratulations. That is a major, major milestone. You know, I was just thinking about a woman's hands who's doing these repetitive motions, which are required day after day to do this work. And I thought that, number one, it could be very meditative. But on the other hand, I thought it also could lead to a lot of physical ailments. Is either the case?
Both are the case. Yeah. I think repetitive, there have many forms of craft have been linked to the same brain changes that meditation provides. And so I think it is very true that it is meditative. I think it's also very true that it is bad for your hands. It's bad for your eyes. A lot of the mm-hmm. Craft techniques have been passed down without kind of a look at ergonomics. So they're, you know, sitting in uncomfortable positions at looms and, you know, a lot. So there, I think there's a lot of kind of health things that need to be looked at it, especially when hours are long or production is high. And so we really take as part of our compliance program, we look at health and safety. We make a lot of recommendations around ensuring that the time that they're spending doing the craft make sure it doesn't kind of cross into the territory of it being dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I think the bigger thing about craft and the repetitive nature is that I think that there's been kind of there is a movement that thinks that cultural preservation movement, that people think that these crafts need to stay the same. And I think that there's a lot to lose by viewing craft that way. I think there's a lot to gain from thinking of craft as something artistic and creative, and that communities can iterate and design can iterate, and that that's one of the things that will keep kind of a younger generation coming back.
Mm-hmm. Well, picking up on that a little bit, you know, I have a colleague who's in the antiquing business, and she was saying that it's pretty much dead in the water right now because people by and large, but young people in particular, millennials, really don't care about antiques. Do you think the same thing could ever happen to handmade?
I hope not. But I think one of the things that's been really interesting to me is that we've never been asked that specific question, but we get asked about automation all the time and like the rise of production transferring to robotics. And I think what's been really interesting is that you've seen a steady increase in the demand for handmade rising at the same speed and at the same time as the rise of automation. And I think in robotics in particular, I think that people who work at a sewing line have a right to fear for their jobs in some ways, because I think robotics is
moving.
I think that
yeah.
it's coming.
Yeah, like transparency.
Exactly. I think the opposite is true for handmade, in that I think that like the human psyche is not going to be comfortable with everything being technology-based and robotics-based. And so I think that there's this yearning for the handmade, which is what we're seeing now, this kind of boom in like gig economy and local and all of these terms.
Authentic.
Exactly. And so I think that we're actually lucky in that I think that those are going to rise at equal pace, because I think that the more things are made mass-produced exactly the same by a machine, the more people are going to want authenticity and real handmade goods. And
so I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right, too. So far, I think we're seeing that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we talked about some of the brands that you work with. Who have been some of your contributors, your financial partners?
We've been very lucky. We have an incredible group of some of the world's best philanthropists, honestly, and they've taught me. So as a 24-year-old when I started it, I had a lot to learn about global development. But we're funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies here in the city, and their economic development portfolio has been fantastic, and I've learned an enormous amount from them. So we're hugely grateful for their support. We're funded by the Swarovski Foundation, the Imago Dei Foundation, which is based in Boston.
Yeah.
I've been a fellow of a number of social enterprise programs, so Ashoka, Draper Richards Kaplan. I'm a young global leader, so we have a kind of range of social entrepreneurship support, which has been also very helpful for kind of my leadership growth. But so, you know, we've been really lucky that I feel like we work with some of the best partners. I do think what I was saying earlier about kind of the misconception that artisan is niche and non-scalable has meant that some major philanthropies have not looked at this sector. That they've seen agriculture and technology and health and a whole range of issues that relate directly to women in emerging markets, and have not seen artisan that way. And I think that tide is changing. I think people are really recognizing that this is where women are working, and that if you want to make a play for economic development for women, then this needs to be part of the conversation. And I'm hopeful we're playing a role in that.
Yeah, I think you are, absolutely. I mean, you're helping define that sector. You said 20% to 60%, that's a broad thing. The more you can begin to get that exact, the more people begin to see
exactly
the breadth and scope of all this, I think the more money is going to be coming your way. Well, talking about learning, you've been doing this for 12, 13 years right now. What have you learned about scaling and growing a successful nonprofit organization?
Oh, my goodness. I've learned everything. I knew nothing when I started looking back on it. But I think knowing nothing was actually a really helpful way to start, because I had no conception that I knew anything. So I learned constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I think my dad is an entrepreneur, too. And when I called him to tell him I wanted to start Nest, he was like, great, you know, send me your business plan, send me your financials. Like, to him, entrepreneurship was very linear in the way he thought about it. Like, you know, you start a business, you grow it, you sell it. And for me, it was very circular. And the more, you know, it was relational. I called people that I knew and asked for help. And that led me to a lawyer and a PR consultant, all these things of people who felt inspired and joined the movement. And our growth has been very organic. I think it took me like 2.5 years to write our first business plan. And by then we like had a business.
And your dad was fed up.
Exactly.
Where is it?
I think he didn't totally understand that. But the more that I've worked with women entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs, and I've really seen that like kind of circular business creation is a legitimate way to run a business and start a business. It's just not the traditional kind of male-centric version. And so I think I've kind of become a vocal advocate for alternative entrepreneurship models and how you can think about growing a business when that's maybe not the way you see growth.
What's it like to work at Nest, and what do you think makes it a special place to work? What's really distinctive about your corporate culture?
You know, I think there's multiple things, but I think the biggest one is that, you know, we're called Nest, which is, you know,
great name.
It was about kind of supporting, obviously, businesses and helping them kind of go off on their own. But I think it really relates to the way our organization feels and runs. My husband is our COO, CFO, and has been my business partner for a very long time. And so in many ways, it is a family and it's run by a couple. And so I think there is definitely that kind of familial element to it. Our trustees, we have, you know, many of them have been with the organization for multiple terms and are very, very close to the organization. So I think, you know, as a nonprofit, we can't pay what a for-profit company could to recruit the best employees. And so, you know, I'm really hopeful that kind of the creative environment, it's fast-paced, we're always changing, we're very nimble, makes it an exciting place to work. And I think we're, you know, we've seen rapid growth and see a lot of growth on the horizon. And so I think hopefully, you know, people like that kind of, we're not totally sure what's coming next, but we're ready for it kind of environment.
Well, I know that you're pretty much open to any idea that comes along, which is probably your greatest strength and maybe your greatest weakness. You know what I mean?
Many would say that, yes.
You know, when it comes to this work, Rebecca, the products that are crafted and produced, as well as the women who do all this day after day after day, what should listeners know and be aware of as it pertains to that?
I mean, I think there's so many ways now with the growth in the kind of handworker economy, as we like to call it, that consumers can be very, very involved in this economy. I mean, they're everything from, you know, Etsy and shopping local mm-hmm. to now big companies and being able to just go to your local Target and buy a basket that was handmade. And so I think there's, and with the increase in transparency, there's very real ways and that people can get involved. I think one of the things that I'm a big proponent of is that I think that we're very black and white as a culture. And so you're either a vegetarian or you're not. And, you know, there's lots of shades of gray. You can eat vegetarian once a week and you can be helping kind of eliminate, support environmental practices. And so, you know, I think people get very nervous around ethical fashion and sustainable purchasing because it seems overwhelming. And like, how could I possibly change all of my purchasing practices? Don't, you know, start with one thing. Yeah. You know, we buy all of whenever we have to buy a present for someone, we buy it locally in our town because it's an easy way to always remember to go to a local store. And so find very easy, very specific ways that you can start changing the way you're purchasing things. And it doesn't have to be all or nothing. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, it's really important to remember that we can just take small steps and those small steps add. And so, I'm a really big proponent of that.
Just get started.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Rebecca. Share with us one of your favorite Nest stories that helps inspire you and carry on with this work.
Sure. I mean, there's so many, but I think one of the things that I'm particularly been reflective on recently is the kind of intersection between the artisan business leadership that we work with and kind of activism. And I think, you know, we're in such a strange time globally. And I think, so I've been thinking a lot about activism and what that means. And reflecting back, you know, one of the first artisan entrepreneurs that we worked with was in Togo, West Africa, and she was a boutique artisan, and she had a number of women that worked with her. And when I was visiting with her, she had, this is probably a little funny to say on air, but she had a wooden penis on her, like right next to her sewing machine. And I was like, what? Why do you have that? And she was like, well, because I hold condom workshops after work. Mm-hmm. And of course she does, because she was a center for the community and that's where women came to work and they respected her and listened to her. And so it was really important that she leveraged that. And, you know, similarly, we have a woman here in our guild who's in Mississippi, and she decided to take time off from her business, which was making hand-carved wooden boxes, to run for political office because she realized that she had a voice in her community. And I think the great thing about social entrepreneurs is that they do have this kind of vision for the community. And sometimes that means growing your business. And sometimes that means you can do much more for the problems you're seeing around you. And so I think we're really inspired by them every day.
Well, Rebecca Van Bergen, the founder and executive director of Nest, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and some of the information that listeners will find there.
Sure. Our website is buildanest.org. And on the website, you can find obviously all the information about us, but there's volunteer opportunities if you want to be a pro bono consultant for Artisan Network. You can find information about the brands that carry the Nest seal so you can buy ethically produced product. So there's a kind of a range of information for listeners.
Including donating.
Including donating, yes. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and a path to success. 85% of Year Up alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support transformative opportunities for young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
We occupy a world where people who are living a problem are rarely, if ever, heard. And when they are, it's typically through the voice of some adult. But what about the children who have grown up into these circumstances? What does the world look like and feel like from their perspective? The organization that is bringing us the personal stories of these young people in a very creative way so we can better understand the world around us is By Kids. And it is a delight to have with us this evening their founder and executive director, Holly Carter. Good evening, Holly, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver, for having me here. It's an honor.
The concept of By Kids is so interesting. What was the genesis of this idea, Holly?
You know, it probably goes back to my childhood, but I think my background was as a print journalist at the New York Times, and I saw some aspects in that world of global issues being covered very superficially and very often by people who would fly from one country to another, often without the language or without cultural bearings. And I felt that was a real disservice to our democracy, that if we want to live in a democracy, we all have it on our shoulders to be informed citizens. And if the news media was not allowing us to hear really impactful, wide stories from the perspective of the people for whom these policies or these disasters or these joys actually affected, we might have a disconnect. And then I had kids, and my kids were growing up, and I started, you know, my thing is if you get annoyed and then get really outraged by something, you better stop complaining and start taking action. Do something, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
So the best I could do was to say, at that point, I'd left print journalism and had gotten into documentary filmmaking. I saw the power of film in a very tangible way. It allows people to learn something that could otherwise in print or through the voice of an old white man, seem pedantic. And film allows you to learn about something through your heart. So my thing is really I'm wired as a social activist. I want to make change. I want to do it effectively and painlessly. Documentary film had, until I got into it, felt a little bit like medicine. And somehow this alchemy of giving a kid a voice, often from places where we don't hear from anybody, let alone through the innocence of a child, seemed like a miraculous way to start really equalizing the news diet of Americans who I think were being cut off, not just for philosophical reasons, but real economic reasons that, you know, having been at the New York Times or watching the networks close their offices in foreign countries because they couldn't afford it. I felt like if we want to be global citizens, which I think many people want to be, we have to prepare our kids for that kind of role. And we were losing the ability to make informed choices as a citizenry. So it was that alchemy that made By Kids possible.
Yeah. Oh, I still think we are so self-absorbed as a culture. I mean, I watch the nightly news on a regular basis and almost have to go to BBC at the end of it to find out what's happening in the rest of the world because we're so focused on ourselves. Have you always liked documentary films, or was this an acquired taste for you?
You know, interesting. I mean, I'm all about, you know, that adage that real life is often more dramatic and crazy than fake.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been driven by story sharing, right? So my crazy uncle who would tell a fabulous story, those memories and those lessons always stuck with me. So
yeah.
I think I grew up in a family of storytellers. And children, certainly as my husband and I were raising our kids here in New York, they don't, you know, nobody needs a morality play. They need to, you know, they need to hear, when I was a kid and I did X, Y, and Z, that's how people learn. So, you know, the reality is I am a really bad writer. Writing is wickedly painful and laborious for me. I mean, writer's block, I've redefined what that means. Literally,
yeah.
The first thing I wrote for the New York Times was on the big business of bird watching.
Right.
It took me 3 months. I had to research every last thing. So I got to a point in my career where I said, you know, it might be nice to get paid for doing things that are fun and easy.
Mm.
And writing is not that for me. And I sat down. I just took a really hard look at my own lifestyle and likes and realized that I spent all my free time either at galleries looking at photography,
mm-hmm.
like Salvador, no, that's not his name, Salgado's work of documenting these diasporas. That's real. That's documentary. Or at films. And I started a documentary film festival, and I began to meet people in that field. And what I loved about it, about filmmaking in general and documentary, just because these people are so passionate, was that journalism is a very solitary endeavor, right? You write alone. Somebody edits alone. It goes out to the millions of that read your stuff, but you're never connected with those people. And, man, the messiness in the community of documentary filmmaking for me meant the world. So I started this film festival so I could meet people like Rick Burns and Albert Mazels. And then I'm like, well, if they can do it, I should do it. And
there
made
you go.
A documentary
the rest is history. Let's talk a little bit about storytelling. Because, you know, it has become one of the more overused words, sort of like innovation and collaboration. And I know in the nonprofit sector, everything I go to is, oh, storytelling, storytelling. How would you define or describe storytelling?
That's a great question and something really potent to think about these overused words. So our mantra is that we teach empathy through storytelling. So those are two of those words that, to me, also are very over. Empathy is overused,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, sure. You're right.
Here's how we define it. We define it as the human act of being in community. And in our case, sometimes it's connecting people in different countries, in different classrooms. It's connecting them in the experience of a shared anecdote. It's the finding the humanity, not statistics. You know, I don't think any of us, well, maybe there are a few of us out there, not me, who responds to statistics.
No.
You know, we made this film about an AIDS orphan in Mozambique. And to hear the statistic of there are 500,000 AIDS orphans, you shut down. It's too
much.
It's overwhelming. So to me, storytelling is finding the human kernel in an anecdotal way that's personal and emotional and sharing it. You know, it's as simple as saying, my name's Holly. What's your name? What's your story? Your story is what makes you different and the same, all in one, you know, in your little nugget.
Absolutely. Everyone has a story. You have said that you believe kids make the best reporters. Why do you think that's the case?
Oh, they're so amazing. They see the world, and they have a nose for BS, right? They don't care about your ego or your politics. They report the way they see things totally authentically.
Yeah, unfiltered.
Unfiltered. And it's so refreshing. And I think on some level, you know, we live in a world that's very divisive, very siloed. I think at the core of what we're trying to do with these stories is reconnect viewers and particularly students with the, as I say, the shared humanity. What do we all have in common? Not our religion, not our race, not where we live, but we were all kids.
Yeah. That's absolutely
really
right.
Simple.
Yeah. Well, share with us the process of going about making one of these films.
So your listeners can't tell that I'm gray-haired, and I went gray-haired because the process is long, but I will explain it. You know, basically we start in New York with the board, and we pick a theme that we call a globally relevant story. So I'll use a very specific example. We knew we wanted to do a film about displacement, and we sat at a board table in New York talking about where we should do that. And George Clooney was flying to Darfur, and you know, every bar mitzvah kid was raising money for Save Darfur. That was not the displacement story we wanted to tell. And this, as I'm dating myself, goes back a while. My Kids has been around for 11 years now. We had a Colombian board member who raised his hand and said how interesting it might be for us to look at displacement through a Colombian child. And we're like, oh, tell us more. And he said, well, Colombia's got, at that point, the second largest displaced population in the world. And he explained why. 40 years of civil war, drug trade. The Europeans and the Americans were driving that drug trade. He said, so how interesting that we could tell a story that, you know, some of these foreign stories that we tell, you might be able to say, well, AIDS in Africa is far, far away. This one, for the first time in our repertoire, was actually a subject that was an American kid could say, oh, man, if I snort a line of coke, that kid Aunt Maria, who is now in Malala's new book, Maria, who lives in a displaced area in Cali, was affected by my action and that ability to connect. So we pick the globally relevant story in theory. We then partner with a nonprofit, in this case in Colombia, wherever we are working, to help us identify a cohort of children from which we can pick our one filmmaker. Mm. We then pick from our stable of miraculous, amazing, talented film mentors somebody who's interested, available, excited, maybe language literate, to go to said chosen child. And they work together for a month. They get a camera and the guidance of the mentor. And the child is the one who is able to tell their story with the help of the mentor to shape the story. They shoot everything except the B-roll.
Yeah.
And they narrate these short 27-minute films. Mm-hmm. And, as I've often said, I remember going to see An Inconvenient Truth, and the lights came up almost, and there was a long list of things you could do. You know, the mandate of these films by kids is that the film itself, sharing the story of this particular child, whether it's dealing with displacement or the ravages of AIDS or climate change or whatever, is that you could actually know enough and care enough to do something about it. And so that our methodology really includes the film being the cornerstone of what starts sometimes very hard conversations. We like in classrooms with teachers guided somewhat by our educational material so that kids can learn how to have hard conversations about race and poverty and all kinds of other things that they are not typically exposed to, particularly these global stories.
Yeah. You mentioned those marvelous filmmakers who serve as mentors. How have you been able to engage them, and who have some of them been?
Oh, God, I love these people so much.
I bet.
They're everybody from Neil Baer, who I happen to be on the board of Colorado College with, and we met, and he mentored our first film. He was at the time the showrunner for Law & Order SVU. Joyce Chopra, who is in the permanent collection at MoMA for her amazing, groundbreaking film, Joyce at 34, where she brought a camera into the labor room when she had her daughter. Albert Mazels, who made his last film, mentored a young Muslim girl here in New York. What a remarkable thing to have. I think he was 86 at the time, this old Jewish legend with a young Muslim girl whose family was willing to have them work together. It was miraculous in many ways. And the whole Anya Baron has just finished a film for us done by a Syrian refugee in Berlin and is now starting work on a film about anti-Semitism in Germany. These people...
Some great names.
These are... They're big-name people, but more importantly, they're really big-hearted.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Films by Kids returns for Season 2 on public television, which premieres nationwide on January 29th, and will in New York on Channel 13 starting on Sunday, March 3rd. Films by Kids returns for Season 2 on public television, which premiered nationwide on January 29th, and will in New York on Channel 13 starting on Sunday, March 3rd. You have four new films by these young filmmakers. Say a word about each, starting with Michael Martin, from right here in Harlem.
So Mike Martin is a 19-year-old who at 17 was sent to Rikers. And we knew that we wanted to do a film around juvenile justice, criminal justice reform, the closing of Rikers, the raising of the age, not just in New York but in North Carolina. I don't know if your listeners know that until very recently, children were treated as an adult. And my two times visiting Rikers is a rude awakening to what that actually means. We've got a film about real societal change happening in one generation in Senegal. We have a young girl who made a film about how had she been born really 20 years ago, she would have been forced to be married probably at 10 or 11. She would have been cut genitally, and she now is a happy kid free to go to school, choose the spouse of her choice and go on about a great life.
Fantastic.
We have another film that was shot in Nicaragua done by a young girl who talks about climate change ravaging coffee growing, which her family has relied on for generations and very proudly. And last but not least, we have Out of Aleppo, which is made by Mo Shasho, who's a young Syrian refugee in Berlin who t- talks very poignantly about his family's readjustment to life in Germany and his hopes and dreams.
Mm-hmm. And you have a narrator for this series, don't you?
We have a great narrator for the second season. Ashley Judd is doing it again, and she too is magnificent. You know, the first season, we were so lucky and grateful, and there were a few people in my circle who said, oh, Ashley Judd, that name sounds vaguely familiar. I think now with the Time magazine cover, there's probably not anybody in the world who doesn't know Ashley, and she's spectacular. She takes this very seriously and is just a real asset to
us.
Yeah,
oh, absolutely. A wonderful glue to hold the whole thing together for viewers. So, Holly, what's the impact on an audience of hearing these stories about these very complex situations you just described in the voice of children?
So I think I will answer it anecdotally. You know, we can proudly say when we digest all the platforms that we have put in place to distribute these films with the educational material, we have public television that reaches 84 million households. We have an amazing partnership with Discovery Education that reaches into half the schools in America with our films
great.
And curriculum. We have CBS News. We have a nice partnership with them that reaches millions of people. Public television, PBS Learning Media does a great job getting it out to teachers. When we digest all of that, we have the reach of 246 million students and viewers. That, you know, as I say, when statistics come at people like Big Whoopie-Doo, right? But I will tell you, I have been in the room when the lights come up and we can have a conversation about something like juvenile justice. People, you know, the questions that come out prove that these kids can digest things at a very sophisticated high level.
Mm-hmm.
There were, I think we had a couple of middle school kids at the premiere screening of I Could Tell You About My Life, which is Mike Martin's film. And these kids are able to digest something. You know, this is a film about what it means to be a young black male in America.
Yeah.
There are deep and potent elements of what it means to be black, what it means to be poor, what it means to be incarcerated. And these children were asking questions of Mike that were just, you know, like, why did you go to jail? And Mike said something that hushed everybody in the room.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say it's because I'm poor or black. He took some time. He said, that's a very good question. Nobody's ever asked me that. He said, the reason I went to Rikers is because I was bored in middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow, this little kid got elicited what could be the biggest solution of the criminal justice problem that we have in America. Don't let kids get bored in middle school or elementary school, or they're going to turn, you know, Mike talked at length about not only was it not having a classroom of support, that the bad behavior of the other kids, he was probably the smartest kid in middle school class.
Yeah.
And the teacher was so busy dealing with behavioral stuff. And then he said, and then I'd be done with 8 hours of having to put up with that and not learning anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'd walk 5 blocks to the basketball court, and the city didn't have resources. That was locked. So we'd walk 20 blocks for another basketball. That was locked. So you're like that kid. And it just those kind of conversations are the things that prove that this is invaluable. Another example is we've been very lucky to have Poet Against Prejudice, which is our young Yemeni filmmaker who moved to Brooklyn when she was 15, mentored by Albert Maysles. And we have done a lot of dog and pony shows with this spectacular film, both with Faiza, the filmmaker, her brother-in-law is the highest-ranking Muslim in the New York City police force. Just a magnificent family, and we've taken this film out a lot. I did it recently in Bergen County that invites us during Anti-Violence Week, and it's interesting that they equate Islamophobia and the kind of torture that Faiza was put through for being Islamic in post 9/11 New York. It's also really a film about bullying and about immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, there have been opportunities for this film that have blown me away. So I sat on a panel next to the guidance counselor at one of these Bergen County high schools. And he says to the 2,000 high school students for whom he works, and there's an element of, you know, keeping the demeanor, right?
Yeah.
He says, I saw this film a few days ago, so I was prepared for this. I had tears streaming down my face.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'll tell you why. I came here. I've never told any of you guys this. I came from the Dominican Republic. See the scar on my lip? I got beaten up because I didn't speak English. Mm-hmm. I didn't look like all my classmates. And I watched this film of a young Muslim woman, and I saw myself in it. And that, and then the woman on this side who ran the anti-bullying program said, I've never shared that I came, I think she came from Morocco, and I was bullied horribly, and I've held that. That was a shameful thing. I've held it in. So I think my point is that these kind of heartfelt translations of personal stories can open other people to be able to tell their story. And in that, you know, I think we've seen that in the Me Too movement, that it took one brave person to say, this is what happened to me, and the flood happens.
Great example. That really is very, very powerful. You know, you reeled off those partnerships a moment ago, but I know how difficult it is to forge those partnerships with public television and Discovery and CBS. What's the key, you think, to making those partnerships work?
You know, it was an idea that had to happen. Mm-hmm. And people that have seen it, heard it, experienced it, can't get to helping fast enough. And so I think it's the power of the idea that nobody was doing this. There are lots of people that give film cameras to disadvantaged kids. We have a few amazing programs here in New York. But it was really something different to be saying, we Americans need to be hearing about the world in a way that we can digest. And it was filling, you know, maybe the CBS deal is because they really understood that this was something they weren't doing.
Right.
I think teachers are, you know, I have a secret weapon. I have a few secret weapons. One of them is Seth Godin, who's a beloved advisor to us. And he said, your audience are teachers. Teachers will see one of these nine films, fall in love, because there's nothing like this, that in 27 minutes you can be talking about what it means to be a black young man in America in a way that their kids will relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is successfully teaching empathy in our classroom. And certainly global citizenry is not, you know, we don't teach ethics, we don't teach civics anymore. This fills a void.
So, yeah, it brings together a lot of things.
Yeah, I think we've been really smart in being in front of the right people. So we've made a real purpose out of getting to the NAIS conference, which is for all private school heads, went to that once and presented. Have been to the Worldview Conference at UNC. We go to South by Southwest, EDU. You know, getting in front of the teachers who not only can learn to like one and then say they want all eight of the others, they also come back to it every year. So if they're teaching, you know, who knew? Who knew that teachers could relate to what we do for their kids that are learning English? You know, it's all of our films are subtitled.
Mm-hmm.
There's a, you know, we didn't set out to say we're going to be an ESL tool, but there you go. So I think, you know, I think it's the idea. Yeah. And I often say, you know, I got into this because, as I say, I found writing so laborious. I love film. I was raising my own kids, and I saw a lack around how to teach them empathy other than being a kind parent myself sometimes, if not always. the reality is community service is a flawed model in this country.
Uh-huh.
I think schools, you know, we often say schools don't teach in the right way. So our kids are not only learning through moving image because they're on their phones all the time, and YouTube is like 12 times more used video than non-video.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids are absorbing their entire world through moving image, and they're learning to express themselves through moving image, just like me. They don't like to write either.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And we had to come, you know, to me, I want to get to the people out there who are really trying to forge educational revolutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Emerson Collective with Laureen Jobs.
Yep.
There are people really trying to blow up the model of school. And I think we fit really nicely into this idea.
I would agree. Yeah. You have to meet these kids where they are, not where we would like them to be, maybe, or not where we were ourselves. And that's what this does. Let me close with this, Holly. Aside from speeding up one season to the next, what's your vision for the future of BiKids, and where would you like to see the organization, let's say, 5 years from now?
Five-year goal is an annual budget of $1.5 million that mm-hmm. allows us to, you know, we basically begged and borrowed to get us to this point. We have you know, Final Cut post-production house donates all of their post-production work. There are lots of people that are doing pro bono work in order to deliver professional national television at the quality we like and do it on time. We need real money to pay people. So the goal is simply 5 new films, season 3 for 2020, and every year beyond that. And we need some strategic partners in not even just the fundraising sphere, but people that can really understand how the more our American classrooms have this kind of content, the better off we all are.
For sure. Well, Holly Carter, the founder and executive director of BiKids, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Where can people learn more about the organizations, the films, the kids, and help support this work if they're so inclined?
Thank you so much. It's www.bykids.org.
Thanks, Holly. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.